Members, 1 o'clock having arrived, I'm going to call the March 10th, 2022 meeting of the House Taxes Committee to order under rules 10.01. And for those who, the audience out there, if you want to find out all the materials that we as members have, go to the House of Representatives website, go to committees and divisions, go to taxes committee, and then look to the right-hand side. So with that, Ms. Griska, if you would please take the roll.
Representative Marquardt.
Marquardt present.
Representative Marquardt present. Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Lislegard present. Representative Davis. Representative Agbaje.
Present.
Representative Agbaje present. Representative Carlson.
Carlson's present.
Representative Carlson's present. Representative Detmer. Representative Garofalo.
Garofalo present.
Representative Garofalo present. Representative Gomez.
Gomez present.
Representative Gomez present. Representative Herr. Representative Hertas. Representative Hertas present. Representative Howard. Representative McDonald.
McDonald present.
Representative McDonald present. Representative Miller.
Miller present.
Representative Miller present. Representative Moran. Representative Mortensen.
Mortensen present.
Representative Mortensen present. Representative Robbins. Representative Sandel. Representative Schultz.
Present.
Representative Schultz present. Representative Stevenson.
Present.
Representative Stevenson present. Representative Swazinski.
Present.
Representative Swazinski present. Representative Joachim.
Present.
Representative Joachim present.
Representative Herr is present.
Representative Herr present. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Griska. And I think Representative Howard is also in attendance.
Present.
Very good. Next on the order of business is approval of the minutes for March 8th, 2022. Representative McDonald, would you like to move those minutes?
I'll move it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lislegard moves approval of the March 8th, 2022 minutes. Any discussion or thoughts? If not, I'm going to call for a vote. If members would please temporarily unmute. Vote on the March 8th minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The March 8th, 2022 minutes are approved. And Representative Moran is also here in attendance. Before we start, we have three bills today that will be laid over. I wanted to get back. And Representative Garofalo had asked a question about future meetings possibly being in person a couple meetings ago, and I didn't get back to him last meeting. So what I have found out is that, of course, right now we still have to provide a hybrid approach for the public and also for some staff members who have exemptions. And so the thought right now is there's a lot of committees meeting and kind of a lack of capacity to do that here in the state office building. But after the break, when there's less committees meeting, like Ways and Means and Taxes, the Capitol Room 120 is a possibility that we could hold a hybrid meeting. We still have to keep it open some way for the public to be able to be involved, and also staff that have exemptions. So anyway, it's in short, I guess it's a possibility, but it would not occur until after the break, and then it would be in Capitol Room 120. So we will be looking into that. So Representative Davids is in attendance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. So with that, we're going to move to our first bill, House File 3817. It is a Representative Haley's bill. Do I hear, would someone like to move that for the committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Les Lagarde moves House File 3817 to be laid over for possible consideration for the House Taxes Omnibus Bill. Representative Haley, welcome to the Tax Committee. Please present us with your bill.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Pleased to be here today. Good afternoon, members of the Tax Committee. House File 3817 addresses a tax issue related to what's called the Nuclear Decommissioning Trust Fund. Xcel Energy is required by the federal government, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to collect costs from its customers to put into a trust so that money would be there in the event that the plant is ever decommissioned. The money collected again from ratepayers sits in this trust, which is a completely separate entity from Xcel Energy as a company. The investment earnings on this trust are taxed by the state of Minnesota, and that's the issue that this bill addresses. I'm going to have turn it over to my testifier to go into more details on it, but want to also point out that nothing in this bill changes the fact that a trust exists for decommissioning. Nothing undermines the integrity of that fund. We are just dealing with the tax issue on the earnings in the trust fund. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to Jim Pearson from Xcel Energy.
Thank you very much, Representative Haley. Mr. Pearson, welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself and please proceed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm Jim Pearson with Xcel Energy, and I'm happy to be in the Tax Committee today supporting Representative Haley's bill, and thought I would maybe emphasize a couple of points that she made and perhaps provide a little bit more context, and of course, I'll answer any questions I can. So as Representative Haley said, the trust fund is a separate legal entity that separate from Xcel Energy. And through the regulatory process, we collect money from our customers, and that money is in our part of our rate case. And so through the rate making process, money is collected and sent to the trust fund that is physically located in the state of Pennsylvania. So this bill looks at that trust fund and the earnings that the fund accumulates through investment and interest is presently taxed by the state of Minnesota. And so as we go through various regulatory procedures, we need to ensure that that fund is maintained for the purpose that it is there for. And so any money coming out of it on an annual basis, we need to recoup through rates. And so to the extent that the interest is not taxed on an annual basis, more money stays in the trust fund, and thereby we need to collect less from ratepayers when we go through the rate making process. I do want to be clear, when that time comes, our plants, when they reach the end of their operating license and decommissioning efforts are underway, money would come from the trust to Xcel Energy, and at that time we would be taxed as income. And so again, this is a really a tax issue involving the trust fund, not Xcel Energy. So again, I appreciate Representative Haley moving the bill, and certainly support her efforts to kind of avoid this double taxation, and would be happy to try to add further context or answer any specific questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pearson. And so just before we move on, the revenue estimate is for 2022, $5.4 million, and then 23, 24, 25. In each of those years, it's 4.1 million. So, Mr. Pearson, one question, and then we'll go to Representative Miller. So, one of the reasons I wanted to have this bill before the Taxes Committee today is it sounds like this could save ratepayers quite a bit of money over time, because the decommissioning process takes like 60 years, but you can only tax, you'd only be able to apply this tax back to the ratepayer kind of during the time it's in operation, because of kind of this condensed time, there's actually a bigger savings for ratepayer. Am I understanding that right? Or can you explain that?
Sure, Mr. Chair, that's a great point, and I appreciate you calling that out. We are able to collect the money for the trust fund, as well as the tax payments, from the present time through the operating license. So in the case of the Prairie Island facility, which is located in Representative Haley's district, that plant has two reactors, and one operating license expires in 2033 and the other in 2034. So from today until 33 and 34, we're able to collect money from the customer, from our customers, through rates. But your point is exactly right. The decommissioning trust fund, by its very definition, will be in existence long after the plant closes. And so we need to collect tax liabilities for that 50 to 60 year period now, so up front, or between now and the operating license expiration. And so it does have a bigger impact on rates than it does the annual tax liability. So again, that's a process that we go through with the Public Utilities Commission in our rate making process. We currently have a rate case before the commission. And so all of these numbers and details will be decided through that process.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pearson, thanks for coming here. I just want to make sure I'm not too confused. So if you could help clarify. So this is a separate fund that I think you said is sitting in Pennsylvania. That doesn't matter to me. But it's a separate fund that's sitting on its own, and it's collecting through the agreement that was made to build this fund at X amount of dollars a year or X amount per ratepayer, whatever. But it builds. The account builds, right? And that's the point of it. And I don't have a problem with the interest being tax-free. What I'm confused about is that interest, you know, the proceeds from the investments, that money, you're kind of making it sound like that doesn't stay in the trust fund. I mean, my first question is, does that money from the investments stay in this trust fund?
Mr. Pearson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Miller, yes, I apologize if I wasn't clear. We want to make sure that the fund, the trust fund, is adequately funded for any decommissioning activities that will be necessary. So we put that money into the fund. As that fund grows, all of those investments stay within the trust fund. Money doesn't flow from the trust fund back to Xcel Energy until decommissioning begins, which obviously wouldn't occur prior to the expiration of the license or the operating license of the plants.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you. So what I'm hearing you say, so tell me if I'm saying this wrong. The point is, if you're paying taxes on this, then effectively to get that trust fund up to where it needs to be when you can no longer put money in from ratepayers, you'd have to increase the ratepayers' amount that they put in against those taxes. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Miller, that is correct. So we need to make sure that the future tax liability that exists from the point the plants close through that, you know, that 50, 60 year decommissioning period, we have to make sure that the tax liability is collected now, so we have that money to pay. So hopefully that helps clarify your question.
Yeah, clear enough.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's it.
Very good. Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Miller, for asking that question, because that was part of the question I was going to ask as well. So the ratepayers are paying upfront for those liability costs for after when the plant is decommissioned. I don't see anywhere in the bill, though, that says that the savings that you'll get from not having to pay franchise taxes on this will actually go back to the ratepayers.
Great question, Chair Joaquim. Mr. Pearson, how does that, you know, if we were to provide this and the tax was exempt, how do the ratepayers get that savings?
So, Mr. Chair and members, that's the important point, and I think that was Representative Haley's first question to us as well. So that process is a different process. It's comes back to the ratepayers in the rate making process. So to try to give clarity to this, when we propose a rate case like we did this last November, as part of that case, we have a budget in to handle this liability. I don't know off the top of my hand what we built in November. I could certainly follow up. But for discussion purposes, let's say that is $50 million. So through that rate-making process, we then evaluate and the commission looks at that and determines, okay, that makes sense or that doesn't. If this bill passes, then obviously we modify that request because we don't have the future tax liability on the time post-plant operation. So that is how that return to ratepayers works, is through the rate case process. And if we wanted to think about language to that effect to ensure that, you know, we're certainly open to that conversation, but it is part of the larger overall rate case, and the PUC is the one to ensure that money flows back to ratepayers.
Chair Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Pearson, for explaining that. I'm not as familiar with that process, but it's not just, you're not asking for the exemption just for those future funds after it decommissions. You're asking for the exemption on the franchise tax for the funds that are sitting in there right now as well. Is that accurate?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and members, we are not looking backwards. So we are looking at it a go-forward basis. So we would look to, if the bill were to pass, we would reevaluate the assumption we have on the tax liability from this point going forward. Hopefully that helps address the question.
Chair Joaquim.
Mr. Chair, I understand that this going forward, I'm just saying it's not just on the tax liability of after the plant's commission, but I know that's all into the consideration when you look at the rate paying. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question would be kind of along the lines of cash storage costs. So would this fund be used to pay the cash storage fees if, let's say, foreseeably you'd have a nuclear plant that's sitting idle or being decommissioned and no plan is yet to move that someplace else? Would this fund be used to pay those cash storage fees to the RDA?
Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski, I don't believe that's the case. The decommissioning trust fund is there to deal with the cost of physically disassembling or taking down the plant. So this is really for those costs. And so the RDA funds that are generated due to the dry cast storage being located at each of our facilities, that is outside of the trust fund. Those dollars come and they reside within the state of Minnesota. So that's a separate process. This decommissioning trust fund is really for the removal of the plant and dealing with all of the issues associated with decommissioning a nuclear facility.
Representative Swazinski. All right, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Pearson, for your testimony. Just to clarify, so make sure members understand that every single penny of rate reduction that comes from this bill and tax reduction is returned to the ratepayers. There is no, quite simply, Xcel Energy cannot get rate reimbursement for something they didn't pay. And so there was some concern. It sounded like there were some concerns about that money falling to the bottom line or an enriched dividend. Just remember that every penny you put into this is in effect having lower rate costs for all the consumers in Excel. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Before I go for any other members' questions, is there anyone else who wants to testify on House File 3817? I don't see any. So, Representative, we'll go back to members. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Mr. Pearson regarding decommissioning. And what was the length of time you said? I thought I heard of 30 years worth of decommissioning of the nuclear plant.
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, the length of decommissioning is somewhat dependent on the plant in question. I would, you know, I'm certainly no expert on all of the steps involved to decommissioning a nuclear facility. I would think, however, that it would be longer than 50 years. The decommissioning process is obviously extremely detailed. There's, you know, a very tremendous, very extensive regulatory oversight through that process. I'm pretty confident that extends beyond 30 years.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I hear you saying, Mr. Pearson, hopefully we can come to our senses and decide not to decommission and to tear down a nuclear plant where it's the cleanest and most cost-affordable form of energy in the world. And when France and other countries around the world are building them up, you know, by the hundreds or by the 10, you know, 10 a month or 10 a year, rather, it seems ridiculous. And, you know, this is off topic, of course, Mr. Chair, but to be decommissioning energy that's the most affordable and cleanest form of and steady form of energy. So hopefully we'll come to our senses in 30, 50 years.
But wouldn't you agree, Mr. McDonald, Pearson? Do you plan on still serving in 30 to 40 years?
No. No, but maybe my son will.
Okay.
If he comes to his senses, maybe he won't either. Maybe Mr. Pearson has a thought on that.
Very good.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair and Representative
McDonald. It was maybe more of a statement, and I want you to stick to House File 3817.
I would simply add we would welcome that conversation in the Energy Committee, so we maybe have you as a guest there sometime as well.
Very good. Thank you. Any other member questions or comments? All right, Representative Haley, final thoughts.
Well, thank you, Chair Marquardt. Thank you, members, for the good discussion. And I appreciate the technical discussion as well to Mr. Pearson. As Jim said, you know, the reduction of rates to taxpayers gets set through this rate setting process with the PUC. And so we can't give an exact number of this impact, but some estimates that we have looked at could be up to $20 million a year. So this is a very significant tax issue, and we can make a difference to ratepayers. I think it's very timely that we're having this discussion today when we are in a period of high inflation and we are in a period of energy costs increasing for Minnesotans. And I also think that this is unique in Minnesota and other parts of the country. With other nuclear plants, these trust funds are not taxed in this way. So appreciate the conversation today, and I'd like your support on House File 3817.
Representative Haley, thank you so much for bringing this forward in your discussion today. The chair will lay over House File 3817 for possible inclusion into the House tax omnibus bill. Thank you much. Next bill up, Representative Eklund. There he is.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the Tax Committee.
Good afternoon. Welcome. We have House File 3073. Would someone care to move House File 3073?
Mr. Chair,
I will move. Chair Joachim moves House File 3073. There also is an A1 author's amendment. Representative Joachim, Chair Joachim, you want to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment.
All right, we have an A1 amendment's been moved. Representative Eklund, anything you want to say about the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment is just some technical fixes that we found that needed to be taken care of so we could present the bill properly.
Very good. Any other discussion or thoughts on the A1 amendment? If not, I'm going to ask you to temporarily unmute yourselves. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. The motion does prevail. The A1 amendment to House File 3073 is adopted. Representative Eklund, welcome, and to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Tax Committee members. House File 3073 is a bill intended to fix a serious inequity with our state TILT payments to counties. To give you a snapshot of just how serious is this very for some counties, here's an example. 95% of all TILT acres are located in the northern one half of Minnesota. Yet less than 10% of new PILT dollars are being sent to where these 95% of the PILT acres exist. Something is definitely wrong with that picture. And adding insult to injury, this extreme disparity exists in direct opposition to the PILT's legislative intent. Chapter 477A specifically states, the purpose of PILT is to address the disproportionate impact of state land ownership on counties with a large proportion of state land. Members, these are but a couple of examples of what Keith Carlson discovered when he authored his new PILT reform study for the Northern County Land Use Board. In a moment, Keith will summarize the study's findings and then explain how this bill will fix the current disparity of PILT payments. First, let me introduce Aiken County Commissioner Ann Marcotte, who chairs the Northern County Land Use Board. And we also have both AMC and Micah on deck to testify as well. Both of these county associations have included this PILT reform bill as one of their top priority bills for this session. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you very much, Representative Eklund. Did we want Commissioner Marcotte to go first, or do you want Keith Carlson to go first and make his presentation?
Mr. Chair, if Commissioner Marcotte could go first and then go to Mr. Carlson, that would be great.
Very good. Commissioner, please introduce yourself for the committee and welcome.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity. My name is Ann Marcotte, and I am an Aiken County Commissioner and the Chair of Northern County's Land Use Coordinating Board, or NCLB. NCLB is a joint powers unit of government consisting of elected county commissioners from 10 counties, Cook, Lake, St. Louis, Coochaching, Itasca, Aiken, Lake of the Woods, Roseau, Pennington, and Marshall. We stretch from the top or from the east to the west on the top third of the state. NCLB was created to provide a local government perspective on the regulation, implementation, and coordination of environmental and natural resource policies with our state and local partners. Within the geographic scope of our members' counties, we have 26% of Minnesota's land area, 61% of the state's forest lands, 56% of Minnesota's regulated surface waters, 60% of state's remaining wetlands, and 70% of Minnesota's public land resources. NCLB counties are responsible for shoreland and wetland management and regulation, administering forest and mineral management programs, and responsible for comprehensive land use management over a vast region. For over 30 years, NCLB has respectfully promoted communication and coordination among state, federal, and local environment and natural resource agencies. NCLB authorized a study to analyze whether payment in lieu of taxes, or PILT, is meeting its statutory purpose. As Representative Eklund pointed out, Minnesota Statute Section 477A.10 is the statute which indicates that to address the disproportionate impact of state land ownership on local units of government with a large proportion of state land. That's the NCLB members. PILT payments have increased 560%. Or $30.8 million over a 41-year history. However, PILT's distribution among the counties have been very unequal, not aligned with the geographical location of PILT land, which is concentrated in northern Minnesota. PILT is supposed to compensate for lost tax base, and in some cases it has accomplished that. However, since 1979, when the category of acquired lands was established, the disparity has consistently grown. Percentage-wise, 1,183% increase in PILT payments for acquired lands, with only 165% increase for county-administered lands. In Aiken County, over half of our land base is public ownership. Our PILT payment in 1980 was 53 cents per acre. In 2021, our PILT payment was $2.59. Counties with acquired acres received between $10 an acre and $100 an acre. Our report, which I hope you have received, finds that the PILT program to date is both inequitable and does not meet legislative intent. Under the legislative proposal you are considering, my county, Aiken County, would receive an additional $750,000 per year. That might not seem much when you're looking at a $9.5 billion surplus, but to our county, reducing the inequities in PILT payments can be a meaningful benefit to our citizens. We are asking not that the monies currently received by counties receiving PILT be reduced or affected. We are merely pursuing equity. The author of our study, Keith Carlson, is here and will present specifics for your consideration. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Keith Carlson, welcome to the committee, and state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, I'm going to share my screen and the PowerPoint that will go through this study.
Sounds good.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, again, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm a consultant that was retained by the Northern Counties Land Use Coordinating Board to do a study of PILT, or payment in lieu of taxes. That was a program that was enacted in 1979 to provide compensation for the cost imposed on counties with hosting state natural resources lands and to compensate for some of the loss in taxes that occurs with that. To be clear, all 87 counties in the state receive PILT currently, and some of those monies are shared with townships and school districts. As Ms. Marquardt indicated, the payments have grown from a gross payment of $5,512,000 in 1980, the first year of payment, to $36,347,000, or 559%. Again, as Commissioner Marquardt indicated, those increases have not been distributed in a way consistent with the geographic distribution of PILT lands. As indicated by her, 95% of PILT lands are in northern Minnesota. Three counties, Lake of the Woods, Kuchiching, and Aiken, have over 50% of their acreage captured and PILT, and consequently do not receive taxes on those properties. Despite that concentration, again, has indicated, the bulk of the increases have gone to the southern portion of the state. There's really only been nominal increases in the vast bulk of northern Minnesota, highlighted in the purple, of less than $5 per acre. Some counties have received increases on their per acre payments of as much as $100 or more. The reason why is the category of PILT lands within a county and the valuation of one of those categories affects the amount of PILT. The most handsomely compensated acreage is what's called acquired natural resources land. Land administered by the DNR that was acquired by purchase, condemnation, or gift. DNR administered other natural resources land, and county administered other natural resources land receive a much lower level of compensation. And that's captured on this table here. The current compensation level for acquired natural resources land is the higher of $5.13.3 per acre, or for the vast bulk of counties, 0.75% of appraised value. For the other two categories, county and DNR administered other natural resources land, the compensation is a much lower, $2 per acre. Since the program was initiated, the vast bulk of the increase has gone to the acquired acreage, $19,579,000, the 1,183% increase that indicated. The DNR and county administered have received much lesser increases. As it again indicated, the statute establishes the purposes of PILT. One has already been explicitly mentioned, to compensate those counties that host a large proportion of PILT lands, but it's also to compensate for loss of tax base and the need to provide services to those lands, and to address the need to manage state lands held in trust for local taxing. These are the county administered, which are tax forfeited lands outside of the confines of cities. The failure to meet the statutory purpose of PILT, along with the growing disparities in the amount of PILT received per eligible acre by county, raises a fundamental question that's been identified as the fairness of the existing distribution formula. Again, this isn't the same chart. This is a different chart. This is the actual payment, but it tells much the same story. In the vast bulk of Northern Minnesota, the compensation is less than $5 per eligible acre. Southern Minnesota, compensation can reach as high as $100 or even $200 or more per acre. The 0.75% of appraised value option for the acquired natural resources is the factor that's driving this. This was added to the PILT program in 1995 and effective in 1996, and has resulted in the huge disparities. Basically, prior to 1996, the disparity between the highest and the lowest county was a factor of 8. The highest compensated county received 8 times more per acre than the lowest compensated. The disparity now is a huge 170 times. The highest compensated county receives 170 times more than the lowest compensated county. And so this raises the question, has the formula kept up with inflation? Well, it depends. If your county is one which largely holds acquired natural resources, acres, and you've seen large appreciations, it more than has kept up. The average compensation for those counties under this 0.75% appraised value is $22.17. Just keeping up with inflation should have dictated that would be $12.92. For the other two categories, it's been a nominal increase from 75 cents to $2 per acre for the county administered land. It should have been at 323, and the DNR administered and went from a lower 37 and a half cents per acre to $1.62 per acre. To $2 per acre. So that technically exceeded inflation, but it started out at a very low base. One of the other things the study looked at was, is the formula meeting its statutory intent in compensating for the property tax loss? And basically we found that for about half the counties, explicitly half the counties, it is not. The chart on this page shows the 10 highest uncompensated counties in terms of how much PILT they receive to how much the county property tax would have been on those now exempt lands. Leading off with St. Louis County coming up with $4,610,000 short, and Hubbard County being $523,000 short. So in culmination, what the Northern Counties Land Use Coordinating Board is proposing to address these issues is, one, to increase the payment for the DNR and county administered other natural resources land by $1 per acre, from $2 to $3 per acre. In addition, to compensate those counties with a large proportion of tax-exempt PILT lands within their confines, creating a new category of aid of 18 cents per acre for counties where PILT land is more than 25% of the total acreage, or 8 cents per acre for those counties where PILT lands are from 10 to just shy of 25% acre. In both instances, these amounts should be indexed for inflation, so they increase just as the acquired natural resources land does currently with the appreciation of those properties. Two other provisions that are captured in the Northern Counties proposal that's in House File 2073. would be one, to prevent cuts in PILT aid by holding counties harmless from valuation reductions in the acquired natural resources land. 37 counties received reductions starting in 2017 because of valuations that showed that the value of those properties had less. And last, to authorize a study to look at what's the value of Lakeshore within county and DNR administered. You know, we're certain that the value of that Lakeshore is quite substantial, but there's no compensation for that since there's no value-based aspect of the aid. I do want to emphasize that, again, that this proposal is not reducing anybody's current PILT. It's just providing some additional compensation to counties that are receive very low compensation, not meeting the statutory principles of the formula. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson. And I think we'll take some questions now. Chair Davids.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. And thank you, Mr. Carlson, for that presentation. You know, we do need to understand that prime southern Minnesota farmland, if it has to go in, there has to be a PILT payment, there's a lot more value than land further north that is not prime agricultural land. I like this bill. It makes a lot of sense. And as long as nobody's going backwards, I'm certainly going to support this provision. But we have to understand that if you're taking ag land out of production in the south, there's a lot more value to the county than non-prime ag land in northern Minnesota. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Eklund for bringing this forward, and also remember that some of that northern land in those counties host a lot of us with tourism industry and have a lot of expenses when it comes to that as well. So glad to see this bill before us.
Thank you. Did Mr. Hilgert or Mr. Mossman want to, Mr. Hilgert, please proceed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Hilgert. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. It's nice to be back up here testifying after a friend and mentor, Keith Carlson. So thanks for that presentation, Mr. Carlson. And as presenters have said before, PILT really underscores a commitment by the state of Minnesota to recognize the direct and indirect costs to communities that are home to state land acquisition. PILT payments have grown over the years to reflect the continued and sizable number of acquisitions from the state, as well as reflecting the high value lands taken off the tax rolls, which Representative and Chair Greg Davids just spoke to moments ago. In certain regions of the state, in certain regions of Minnesota, state land ownership may be over 50% of a county's total acres. I want to give an example. In Lake County, they have 83% of their lands that are tax exempt. And they have a boundary that's more than twice the size of Rhode Island. To this point, PILT is far more than just a local government aid. It represents and provides community solvency. While many PILT acres provide tangible and intangible benefits to their communities, as Representative Joachim stated, through tourism, it is equally the case that many PILT lands require an equal or even greater set of resources to manage than taxable land via solid waste management, law enforcement, and search and rescue costs. I was on the phone with Lake County Commissioner Pete Walsh this afternoon, and he regaled me of a story of a 7 or 8 day search and rescue just years ago that cost multiple thousands of dollars a day for the county to do that. Most importantly, PILT lands represents thousands of acres that cannot be developed to provide a tangible tax base and resource for local communities and future generations. The latter is extremely critical for communities in greater Minnesota who have large geographic districts with similar service demands of other counties, but far less tax base to help pay for said services. For all these reasons, we very much support the bill in front of you today. And as Mr. Carlson noted, this bill does not take away resources from other communities. It tries to lift up those who we believe have not had kind of that equalization of aid comparative to the tax base that they lost and the services they require. Thank you all, and thank Representative Eklund, former County Commissioner Eklund, for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you so much. And before I go to Representative Miller, we'll hear, I think we have one more testifier. Matt Mossman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt and Tax Committee members. Matt Mossman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and also nice to be joined by my predecessor and someone that I've worked with over several decades, Mr. Carlson. MICA has 15 of Minnesota's larger counties in our membership, and notably St. Louis County, which hosts over 1.4 million acres of these publicly tax-exempt state of Minnesota lands. So thank you, Representative Eklund, for introducing this legislation, and we add the support of our association for passage of House File 3073. As noted, a primary statutory purpose of PILT is to address the disproportionate impact of state land ownership on local units of government, and especially those with a large proportion of state land. These other natural resources lands also require services from local governments, such as emergency medical, fire, law enforcement, solid waste, and more, but yet they're not on the tax rolls. And consequently, these are lands that are also unavailable for the kind of value added and development that would add to tax base. And the concentration of these lands make impacts on tax bases all the more apparent. You know, I would just sort of summarize a number of obviously really important points have already been made, but summarized by underscoring that past studies of PILT program, including legislatively mandated studies, have recommended that the per acre flat amounts be indexed for inflation. That is taken out of statute in 2011, and I think it's really at the heart of the disparities that were highlighted in Mr. Carlson's data and analysis. In the absence of annual or periodic adjustments to the per acre payment amounts, areas that are experiencing valuation growth like that referenced by Representative Davids will experience growth in PILT payments while acres compensated on the per acre mechanism will not. So we particularly urge the legislature to increase the annual per acre amounts and to account for inflation in payment levels going forward. And we also support the setting of the floor on downward appraisal adjustments. That, Mr. Chair and members, I urge you to adopt House File 3073. It would better align PILT payments, levels of PILT payments across counties. And we thank you for your time and happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House File 3073 as amended? All right, Representative Miller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm gonna support this bill. I do think we need to address it with PILT, but I can't help myself. This is the time where I have to say what the state does is they do an action, it causes a problem for people, and then we come in the back end with money, and usually not enough money, which is what PILT has traditionally been. And so this is tax committee, not other committees, but I just have to say it. I wish that we would stop buying up all this land. I wish we'd sell land. I don't think we need to do this, but this need to come forward with this PILT money is a direct example of what happens, the unintended consequence when the state owns so much property. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, we've had the proposals in the past to try to help fix this. You know, the biggest contributor to this problem is, you know, the sales tax amendment in the Constitution, and that is driving a lot of this cost in the new acquisition of land. And I forget which member it was. It may have been Representative Drazkowski had a version of this that would, you know, essentially set aside dollars and then use the interest from those dollars through the legacy dollars generated to pay the PILT payments. And, you know, it's if a fund is creating a problem, I believe that the fund should also fix the problem. And, you know, I think this does make a market difference, but, and, you know, and just to the testifier, the last one, I forget your name, sir, but you mentioned that this should be connected to inflation. Do you mean the valuations of the property or do you mean inflation? Because those are, I would say, two different things. If we're trying to, yes, thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Mossman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Sosinski, that's my reference was that as valuations go up, the property that is it, that the PIL payments that are based on the 3/4 of 1% of valuation do go up as a result of that economic growth and the valuation change. And what is happening here is that a large amount of the acreage, and especially where it is heavily concentrated, is set at the flat $2 per acre amount. And that flat per acre amount has not been increasing because it's not adjusted for inflation. And that's what would happen under this bill.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. And just one other thing, you know, and we also be, I believe the state should be looking at, you know, the state's done a very good job of tying up land, especially with the school trust grounds and not allowing development that would most benefit the students. And when we're talking about PILT payments and we're talking about land rental, that if land is being tied up through the state through regulation, you know, it's one thing to pay the PILT payment on something that could be looked at recreationally. It's a completely other thing to be looking at the PILT payment when there could be a potential mine there or have an aggregate mine or something along those lines. You know, if the state wants to conserve, I believe it should pay for it, you know, through PILT, but it should also pay the real value, not just the value of the land, but if it would have its true development happen. You know, if you had a gold mine sitting underneath a piece of property, you'd certainly expect the payment from the state to keep it in conservation to be vastly different than it would be if it was just something where you had a park bench. You know, I think the state really needs to look hard at that to say, you know, if you want to make that commitment to conservation, you also need to make the commitment to actually look at what's underneath the ground as well, because that's what you're holding out from development by the state holding it or regulating it out of production.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. So I have a question for Mr. Carlson. You had mentioned that under the acquired natural resources land, what created the greatest disparity right now was in 1995 when you could take the option of the $5.13 per acre or 3/4 of 1% of the appraised value. And I noticed you said 77 counties went with the appraised value, which, you know, seems to be rising a lot. Are those the more agricultural counties, and the 10 that didn't belong to that would be the least agriculture? Why did 10 counties not take that option if, in fact, that's the option that's expanding the greatest? So, Mr. Carlson?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Again, the counties that did not elect the 3/4 of 1% option are basically those with least valuable lands under the current valuation formula. They're captured in this map here that is in light blue, basically across the northern tier of the state, plus Wilkin and Maurer counties. The reason why they do not participate in that 3/4 of 1%.
Okay, so those are the 10 counties. All right. So most of it then, and I'm kind of getting back to Chair David's question. So most of this is not related to value. But, you know, like, you know, the county administered natural resources land and commissioner administered, that's per acre. So that's not related to. So the only part related to value is that one part on the acquired natural resources land. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. There are a few other small categories that only apply to one or a handful of counties, but the lion's share goes out in the 3/4 that I've identified.
Very good. Thank you. Anyone else have questions? If not, Representative Eklund, thank you for bringing this important bill forward. Do you have some closing comments?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the time and hearing House File 3073. The county I come from, Mr. Chairman, is got 95% of pre-settlement wetlands in the county. So to answer Representative Miller and Representative Swedzinski's questions, we'd love to develop it if we could, but it's really hard to develop on wetlands. But going along with that 95% of pre-settlement wetlands is a very large swath of tax forfeited land and other state lands that Cushing County has to manage. And it's the same for St. Louis and Itasca and all the rest of them. So I appreciate the time, Mr. Chair, hearing this bill, and I certainly hope it will be part of the tax package.
Thank you very much, Representative Eklund. And the revenue estimate for House File 3073 as amended is in 2024, $8.87 million, and in 2025, $9.44 million. So thank you very much, Representative Eklund. The chair will move to lay over House File 3073, or will lay over House File 3073. As amended for possible inclusion into the House tax omnibus bill. Good discussion, thank you. At this time, I'm gonna turn it over to the Vice Chair, Leslie Gard, the virtual gavel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Next item on the agenda is House File 3558. Chair Marcord, would you like to move your bill to be laid over for possible inclusion in the tax omnibus bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3558 for possible inclusion, to be laid over for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Please present your bill.
So, Mr. Chair and members, House File 3558, basically what it would do is move the homeowner's property tax refund and the renter's refund to the income taxes. You would apply for those refunds, or they would now be refundable credits through the income tax. And so right now, the way it works is that if you're a homeowner, you get your property tax statement in March, should be coming out shortly. And then by August 15th, you've got to apply. And then in August, and usually August, September, you will get your refund check. So you're 5 or 6 months after you've actually received this notice. For renters, they actually have the rent paid through property taxes in the prior year. So like for this year, it'd be like 2021. And then they apply and then would not receive their renter's credit until August or September, which is going to be 8 or 9 months after they actually paid their portion of the property taxes through the rent. So what this would do is move it up so that a person, when they file their income taxes, starting in later January through April 15th, they would fill out that information that was needed and then could receive a income tax refundable credit much earlier. So they would get their dollars sooner. It would be simpler, and it's going to include a lot of people right now who would qualify but do not take it or don't know about that. And so it would be very separate. So this bill does not recreate or reinvent the wheel. Prior to 1981, the renter's credit was on the income tax. It was a refundable credit. And also, senior citizens for homeowners were able to apply for the credit on their income tax form. But during the budget crisis of 1981, where they had 5 or 6 special sessions to deal with it, they did away with that. And so therefore it was basically a shift. Instead of having a payment in January through April to get the refund, they then shifted the payment into August and September. So it was eliminated solely to deal with a very difficult budget time. So it probably works better for renters than it would for homeowners, just because renters are getting their credit from the year before. So they would already have that certificate of rent paid and property taxes. Versus the homeowner, there's a bit of a timing problem. Back before 1981, property tax statements used to go out in February. So you'd have this statement in February, you'd have to wait. But now those statements don't come out until March, which, you know, if you want to file your taxes earlier, you've got to wait. So there might be a bit of a problem. If this was to become law, you certainly would need to have some education for people who don't file income taxes, what they would still have to do to get the credit. But let me just give you some numbers of the magnitude of this. And this is from the revenue estimate. And you can see the revenue estimate are some pretty big numbers there. I'm trying to catch where they're at right here. But just individually, as far as the result, oh, the second part of the bill is that it moves from household income to federal adjusted gross income. So it would match the income you're doing on your income tax form. So certain things would not have to be counted. And we had some bills in property taxes that did the same thing. And basically what that does, by now not having to count certain income, according to the Department of Revenue estimate, it would lower income about an average of about 14%, which means you would qualify for a larger property tax refund, and some people who now don't qualify would. So let me just give you the numbers, and then I'll open it up certainly for questions on that. But for current homeowner property tax claimants, just the language change on going from household income to federal adjusted gross income would increase homeowners' refunds about $121 million, or an average of about $210 per homeowner. On the renter side, there would be about 318,000 renters would see an increase of about $40 million just on the language change of the income, and that'd be about an average of about $125 of increase renter's credit. But the number of those currently eligible but not claiming the PTR, that would increase the number of homeowners by 305,000 additional homeowners now would receive the homeowner's credit. That would come to about 340 million with the language change on the income for an average refund of about $1,114. And for renters, it would impact 120,000 renters who right now are not claiming the credit would receive it for a total of about $86 million and an increased renter's credit on the average of $716. Also, just the language change would add 93,000 homeowners at about $53 million and would add about another 36,000 renters at an average of about $411. Per increased property tax refund. So members, this is a big idea. This is huge. This would be some big reform. Like I said, it would bring us back to 1981, at least for the renters. It would be simpler. Renters and homeowners would get their refunds sooner, and it would increase the number of people who should be getting that now would. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm open for questions or discussion.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to note that Representative Moran is present. We do not have any testifiers for House File 3558, and so we'll move to member questions. And I see that we have Representative Sawazinski. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Chair Marquardt, just a question kind of on the process of the new policy. So, you know,
you're breaking up, Representative Wazinski. Can't hear you.
Had eviction moratorium stayed how many months? Better?
Try it again, please. Okay, that's worse yet. Anyone else?
Mr. Chair, I've got a button I control. If I think I'm getting a tough question, I can try it.
Is it better now?
It is now.
Okay, sorry about that.
Go ahead, my friend.
Yes, it's not a tough question, Mr. Chair. It's an inquisitive one, that's all. So, you know, with the, we had the eviction moratorium for the last few months that we just kind of came out of through COVID, and we had a lot of defaults, a lot of folks potentially not paying rent. Under this new program, if the state is paying a percentage of rent or have backfilled all of the rent that was owed due, or if someone has actually not paid rent, would the potential renter get all of their money, a percentage of their money under this plan, or how would that potentially work out? So if the state paid all their rent for the last year, would the person get a refund even though they didn't actually pay rent?
Chair Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski, I think that's a great question. And I will have to ask staff to see if they would know. But basically, right now, when you apply for your M1 PR form, you've got to have a certificate of rent paid. And on that, we calculate 17% is constituting property taxes. So I'm going to turn this over to staff because I'm just thinking this through right now. But I would think if, in fact, the rent was not paid by the renter, that wouldn't show up then on the certificate of rent paid. But like I said, I'm just thinking that through. I don't know. Maybe Mr. Williams or someone would actually know the answer. So,
Mr. Williams.
Chair Lissler-Garden, members. So the property tax refund program definition of rent constituting property taxes is defined as 17% of the gross rent actually paid in cash by a claimant for the right of occupancy. So I think that probably if gross rent was paid by someone other than the claimant or was not actually paid in cash by the claimant, it would not count towards rent constituting property taxes. That's my best guess.
Representative Swazinski. Okay, that must answer this question. Anyone else would like to ask the chair? Okay, seeing no further questions, Chair Marquardt, would you like to have the final? Oh, there we go. We got Chair Joachim coming in late.
Thank you, Chair Lissler-Garden. I feel like I've been talking too much, so I was waiting to see if anybody else would raise their hands. A little chatty today, maybe too much coffee. Chair Marquardt, thank you so much for bringing this bill. The AGI in particular, changing it to AGI instead of household income, really makes it a lot less complicated for folks. I don't know if that's what's prohibiting some of the uptake for the folks that could get property tax refunds, but it really does make a difference when they're trying to figure out all these things that they have to add back in. So that that part of the bill in particular, I do appreciate. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Anyone else? Going once, going twice. Seeing no further questions, Chair Marquardt, do you have any final words to your bill?
Thank you very much, Representative Lissler-Garden. Well, I better read the revenue estimate. I found it here, so that's always important. So in fiscal 2023, it would be a $1,545,000,000, and that half of that is the shift of $876 million. That's what's currently spent on the program, and it would now be paid twice in the same fiscal year. So like if we were to put this in effect for next year, for 2022 taxes, they would still get the refund for this year in August. And then starting, they would get the credit when they filed next spring. So it would fall into the same year. So it actually has to count twice. So that's half that cost. And then the other half cost is the increase in the number of people that would qualify or that would now claim it, and those that would benefit by the moving from household income to federal adjusted gross income. So again, members, I think this would be very significant, and we've always tried in the tax committee to try to benefit as many people as we can under the law. and also to try to make the system more simple for filers. And this certainly would do that and move in the right direction. So thank you for your consideration, and members, and that completes my testimony. Thank you.
All right. With that, Chair Marquardt renews his motion that House File 3558 be laid over for possible inclusion in the tax omnibus bill. Now I get the pleasure to hand the virtual gavel back over to Chair Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Representative Les Lagarde. So members, thank you for your work this week. Next week on Tuesday, we're going to hear a housing aid bill from Representative Howard. And we're also hearing a bill from Chair Davids regarding kind of timing of sales tax payments regarding various events and so forth. So thank you. With that, members, we are adjourned.